once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Okay. We did it
again.
I
always forget what to do at this point. Okay, the personal wealth coach, we're supposed to do disclosures and disclaimers here. The personal wealth coach is not just the name of the radio program. It's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisor in Salado, Texas, that has the same two guys giving investment advice that are also the same two guys who give educational information on this radio program. Which tells you that this is educational information and not investment advice. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their circumstances, goals, objectives, etc., etc., etc. And education is general in nature. The information that we do give educationally on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we don't guarantee or warranty accuracy, complete accuracy or completeness or anything else about it except for the fact that we think it's probably right. We advertise on KTEM, but we don't pay them for the radio program. They don't pay us either.
And what's more, the advertisements are all for the radio program.
Which is weird.
Yeah. We advertise the radio program for them. Interesting.
And they advertise on our radio program.
Yes.
Which is a very complex socioeconomic interrelationship. Actually, it's very little social and mostly economic.
What we're saying, Senator, is there was no quid pro quo. I just like saying that.
Cause there was no quid pro quo. I have to find where quid went to.
He was amateur for sure. Otherwise, he would have been pro.
Right. There's no pro. Anyway, telephone number in here, presuming.
That's
hopefully
a big presumption.
That today is August 10th, 2019, where you are. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join with us and give us any questions, thoughts, comments, or anything else verbally on the telephone you'd like to do. You can also email, I don't know if you've got your email up, but I've
I
got
do.
Mine. Okay, Jeff or Jake, either one, at tpwc.com. And a little thing will pop up on my computer here and tell me that I got an email. And we'll try to respond to that email. By the way, last week...
Is that what that is? When it says you've got mail, that means that I shouldn't be going out to the post office? That it's on my computer?
It means you have a son.
Ah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
last week, we had some callers who couldn't get through, said the call cannot be completed as dialed or whatever. And it wasn't our fault. It wasn't the station's fault. Apparently AT&T decided to go on strike or something and wouldn't let the telephone calls go through to us and a lot of other people. But apparently it's working this week. So again, the telephone number is 254-773-1400. And we'd love to have you call in with questions, comments, or thoughts about anything to do with the economy, investing, or things of that ilk. So what happened this week?
Well... you want to say about the market? I've got some other specifics, but I bet you want to talk about the market first.
Well, it's kind of nice.
Just
not much happened in the market this week.
Well, a lot happened. It just didn't average out to be much of anything.
Just shows you that the window that you use, the filter that you use when you look at data, is really, really important. For example, the fact that if we measure against the close of the market last week and the close of the market this week, the S&P 500 stock index declined 0.46%, which is insignificant. Now, the fact that it is down 3% from its high makes it a minor dip, nothing significant. But it was down 7% at the close, I think, on Monday or middle of the day Tuesday or something after the president tweeted a couple of things. It finally crawled back up again. But the end result is the stock market for the week didn't do much if you just measured it for the whole week. Now, what's critical to understand, particularly if you're looking at your portfolio, is the stock market is slightly lower today. The index, the S&P 500 index, is slightly lower today than it was at the end of September last year. Yeah, it's up 3% from where it was exactly this time last year. But
just wait a month. If it just stays where it is, the 12-month, the year-over-year return will be a negative.
And if you, unless you're 100% invested in the S&P 500, you probably didn't see a 3% rise in your portfolio.
Right.
If you have other things in there, you probably see a portfolio that's either pretty flat or a little negative at this point. And that's just something to realize. It's not the fault of whoever it is or whatever you're doing or whoever it is or whatever. It's an economics thing, and it has to do with, very frankly, it has to do with the tariffs. And we can get into that later. It's a really fascinating subject to me. The important thing in the markets, at least from my perspective, there's a lot of little stuff. The fact that the oil price is down a little bit, and that indicates global weakness, and oil is down 20% year over year because of global weakness in the economy, and the economy slowing down around the world. And the United Kingdom had a negative GDP turn in for the last quarter. But that's not the important thing. The bond market, which we generally don't pay that much attention to in our day-to-day activities, represented by the 10-year U.S. Treasury, the yield declined. And the 10-year U.S. Treasury note closed with a yield of 1.748, 1.7.5 in effect. And that is with the T-bill, the 90-day T-bill at 2%, that means we have, not only do we have, still have an inverted yield curve.
It's seriously inverted.
It's getting more inverted. As a matter of fact, the 30-year Treasury bond is working its way down each week. We don't track that too closely. But if it just continues what it's been doing for the past several weeks, it soon will be lower than the 90-day T-bill. And there aren't any examples since we've been tracking this where an inverted yield curve that's been inverted this long and is inverted this severely doesn't result in a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. And just I realize that the statistics and the stuff that goes out there talks about other things. West Texas Intermediate oil was down a bit, 1.67%, down 20% from a year ago. I said that earlier, and that's on weakening demand. But that's the story the markets are telling us right now. The stock market is still optimistic.
Demand is down kind of across the board for a lot of the big use items. Yeah. We're seeing it in truck driving. You know, we're famous for that. Famous in our niche. Famous in the financial world to some extent, and that we talked to a lot of people about that in
counting trucks.
Right. Counting trucks. How many trucks are on the highway? That tells us about the economy. And last week you came out with a pretty interesting bit of information that we've got fewer trucks on the highway.
The price for hiring a spot market, in other words, if you just say today, I want to hire an 18-wheeler to go from here to there, and they're going to charge you by the mile, the price is down 18.5% over the last year.
No, that's averaged over the entire country, but it is a serious, serious reversal of what it has been for a long period of time. That's an indicator that's not a widely tracked one that we see as imperative. It means trade is down. Well, what does that mean? What is the economy? Well, it's trade.
There was the old Dow theory, which worked really well for a long time and now doesn't, is that you want to see where the Dow Industrial Average is going to go in the intermediate future. You follow the Dow Transportation Index, and when the Transportation Index drops, the Dow Industrial Index will drop later, and so be prepared for that. Well, the Transportation Index is no longer just transportation, and the Industrial Index is no longer just industrial.
So that doesn't work. There's a lot of non-industrial and non-transportation all mixed in there because it's really hard to keep them apart these days.
But if we follow transportation, and there's no convenient index to follow this on, if you follow the cargo cost rates and the volumes for aircraft, trains, and trucks, and you notice that it is not growing anymore and is starting to decline, there is an indication that we are on the cusp of a recession. Now, I will say this. The trucking industry increased its capacity over the last 12 months by 7%. because they thought that was a good number because the previous year was up 10. In fact, volume has grown about 1% from this time last year. Well, and I say this time last year, this is a lagging indicator. This is basically, the data is a couple of months old by the time it's compiled and we get a hold of it. So it's the same old story. It's not that the economy has gone into recession. It is that the growth rate has been lagging and slowing down and continues to slow.
Right. And if you are in the trucking world, it's likely that you didn't experience a 20% downturn in your income, but you probably experienced or will experience a downturn in your income just because there's a lot more people on the market than there used to be.
And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street last week about fear of vicious cycle for Fed, and mentions that the Fed and Mr. President have possibly entered into an adverse feedback loop with social media. Has this ever happened before in economic history, and what's the outcome for that? I'll hang up and listen to that.
All right.
I can answer your first question with a very simple no.
What was the first question? Let's repeat the question first.
First question was, has this ever happened before in economic history? No. Presidents have had a tendency to be cooperative with the Fed because they realize the Fed has a lot of power.
Well, and let me qualify that. George H.W. Bush went to Alan Greenspan and said, don't raise interest rates. You're going to put us in a recession right as we're hitting the election season. And Alan Greenspan said, my job isn't to get you elected. You appointed me, and I am very respectful of that. But if I don't raise interest rate, we're going to have lots of inflation. And my job is to prevent inflation, even if that means occasional recessions. Well, George H.W. Bush lost his campaign against Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton's slogan was, it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah.
If you go back in time since the founding of the Federal Reserve, you see lots of presidential conflict with the Fed. It is more the...
I think it was Paul Volcker that he went to, though, instead of...
It was Greenspan, because Greenspan was the guy that gave the speech about it.
Oh, okay.
And I was at the speech. So unless he was talking about memories of...
Oh, it was Carter. Yeah, Carter.
Carter did...
Who lost Volcker. His election because Volcker triggered a recession.
Right. And even public sentiment, public statements about the Fed from the president has been sort of normal, not crazy negative. What's different about this is that the regularity with which the president trashes the Fed, basically blames the downturn in the economy on the Fed, but the downturn hasn't happened yet. So he's setting the stage, and the economists of the world are pretty well united, and of the United States for that matter are pretty well united, saying that the major slowdown in our growth has much more to do with tariffs and uncertainty than it has to do with interest rates. In fact, the interest rates have a much lower impact on the overall economy than trade does. Those interest rates are very small amount of the margin in the movement of money back and forth. And while trade is also a small movement, a small amount of margin, it's bigger, much bigger.
And interest rates are really quite low. This is evidenced by the fact that there is a surge in refinancing and mortgages right now because interest rates are so low.
Right.
They're abnormally low. You know, yes, it is entirely possible that the Federal Reserve, by dramatically lowering interest rates, could give a stimulus to the economy. I can also tell you that by dramatically lowering interest rates, the Federal Reserve would scare the bejesus out of the stock market, and it probably cause the stock market to crash, because if they look at the Fed lowering interest rates, suddenly say, oh no, they know something we don't know about the economy that's bad.
Right. And that's what happened when the Fed lowered interest rates this last time around. The market dropped. The market tanked because they were expecting that maybe the Fed would just hold the course and see what happened with trade, but they think that the Fed sees something wrong on trade that hasn't been clearly stated. Now, if they pay attention to what the Fed said and then got a translator from the economic world and then had a thesaurus on economic translations, then they wouldn't have been surprised by this. So the Fed has got some issues right now. And the primary issue that they have is their communication is lacking.
The other thing, and that article that the caller referenced, the feedback loop, is not to do with the social media. It's primarily that the Fed tries to adjust interest rates to keep the economy running smoothly based on what's going on in the economy. And normally things that go on in the economy appear very slowly and disappear very slowly. But a tweet from the president is all it takes to impose 25% tariffs on everything from China. The Fed cannot adequately adjust the economic status of money to accommodate something that can be changed in a tweet. And,
right.
And if they, let's just say the 10% tariff, there's kind of a consensus that I've read. As a matter of fact, I couldn't find any economists who didn't think that this would trigger a recession. But if the Fed then reacts to the 10% tariff by lowering interest rates, and the president pulls the 10% tariff back,
then they've got to raise interest rates.
The point is the interest rate lever moves very slowly in the economy. It's
right.
6 months to a year from the time they change interest rates to you see the effect in the economy. Whereas the president's tweets can obviously on September 1st, the tariff is either going to take effect or it's not. And if it does, we're going to see a significant rise in prices.
We're already seeing a rise
Walmart.
In prices.
Exactly,
in Walmart. This is one of those things that we talked about in the newsletter. So we're starting to see the prices increase at a significant rate. At the producer level. And what that means is that will filter through. Producers don't take cuts in pay well.
Well,
nobody does. And so they may take a little one, but they're also going to raise prices.
We're in what's called an earnings recession, meaning that earnings are not as high this year, but we've now gone two quarters, first and second quarter this year, with S&P 500 average earnings lower than they were previously.
And that's something we predicted last year because you only get that boost in earnings from the tax cut once.
Well, they got a double whammy. They got the boost in earnings from the tax cut. And then the tariffs are beginning to eat into their earnings. Now,
right.
what that means is the price of what they purchase, be it steel when there were tariffs on steel and wood when there was tariffs on wood, or...
And there's still tariffs on all those things, and that's part of the complication is that who it's on is very hard to figure out.
And the end result is that the stuff that they use to make materials, to make things... And to sell things, the things they buy to resell, be it video game consoles or whatever, or furniture, the materials in there are in many cases largely imported. And with tariffs, when they get hit with tariffs, what they've done so far, retailers so far and wholesalers have absorbed the price increases without increasing prices to the consumers because the consumers, they're concerned the consumers will stop buying if they do that. And as a result, their earnings are down. Their profitability goes down. But the profitability has been shaved back to the point where everybody except Walmart, which has an amazing profit margin of 25%. I'm not talking about a markup. I'm talking about profit margin of 25%.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
But, for instance, Home Depot has a profit margin of 10%.
If there's a tariff on wood, they can't eat very much of that.
Right, and so it would take half of their earnings away, which would crush their stock.
How much wood would a Home Depot chuck?
I knew you were going to do that. So the typical retail store you go to that's not Walmart has a relatively thin profit margin.
Wait a minute. I think the typical retail store that people go to is Walmart.
But if it was anything except Walmart,
okay.
It has a very thin profit margin. And they've actually eaten about as much of that tariff cost as they can. And they're going to be forced with the 10% tariff. And this is the reason that Mark Zandi at economy.com said, and he, by the way,
he's the Moody's guy, right?
He's the Moody's economist, chief economist. He called the 2008-09 recession perfectly, both as to its severity and its cause and its timing and everything. And so it got quite famous for that, and justifiably so. He was one of the few voices that was saying, hey, this is coming. And he's saying that this 10% tariff will tip us over in 2020 into a recession unless it is pulled back. And if it goes into effect, basically if it's in effect about a month, he was saying, it's too late to pull it back at that point. Because the slow percolating through the economy will still occur, and the uncertainty that it might come back on at any moment,
and more importantly,
will keep the prices up.
The long term, and this is why there's a delay. There's multiple reasons for the delay. Number one, it takes a while for a cost of shipping in a raw material, for that raw material's price to affect a finished material's price, because it's got to be added into the mix. It's got to be put together. It's got to ship around through the whole supply chain. Then it's got to go from the wholesaler to the retailer. And then you start seeing a change. There's another issue, and I mentioned it sort of in passing there, the supply chain. If we have a major increase in price from, say, China, the CFOs start looking at other sources. Once they have another source, they don't sign a one-time deal with the, I want one chip for an iPhone. They have a certain volume that's expected. They have a certain period of time that's expected, and all this is based in contracts. The contracts on many of the Chinese goods have reached their end and are just doing a renewal schedule rather than you've got to do this for 5 years or 10 years to recoup a certain amount of initial investment. So changing the supply chain means that you get into agreements with the new sellers so that they can change their factory floor. Their factory floor is going to require retooling. They've got to get different machines in there to make the things that you want. And then they've got to get people trained on those machines. And that means that they need some kind of a longer term obligation, which means even if the 10% tariff then goes away, we're still locked in at a slightly higher cost because you can't go back to the cheapest market for it. So all of that, it's layer on layer on layer, these ripple effects that happen. Because if you present a business owner with a whole set of higher costs, they're going to do their best to find a better source for those products. And sometimes that's a big, big transition. And what's really bad about all of this is that it puts the American manufacturer on a bad footing. Even if all the tariffs go away, we're still locked in at a higher price than we were before because we changed manufacturer because of a tariff, which if you think of that as an artificial increase in price, it had nothing to do with the actual production of the item. It had to do strictly with an extra tax. So if you go to another place and then the cheaper place is back open and running again, you're still locked in at this higher price and our competitors are not.
One of the things that we're seeing, and it's again classic economics, is when you, let's just say there's a 10 or 25% tariff on something coming out of China that previously had dominated the market. When a competitor comes in and says, we'll replace that, they don't replace it at the price, the original price it was before the 10 or 25% tariff. They may shave 1 or 2% off of that, but they are then free to raise the price. The same thing is true in the United States. The steel manufacturers and the steel workers and the steel everything in the United States raised their prices when the tariffs went into place.
Didn't just continue to sell at a much lower price and all the demand drawing from there. They raised their prices. They went up to parity with imported steel.
Incidentally, they got what I refer to as a slang term called gobsmacked the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of layoffs going on in the steel industry right now.
The reason is you may have read a while back that there's a dam that collapsed in, I think, in Ecuador, at a iron ore pit. I don't remember which country it was in South America, but it killed a lot of people because this flood of mud came through and wiped out the people working in Brazil in this iron ore pit, and they also wiped out several villages downstream. Turned out that this is, I don't remember the name of the company, but it's Parabus, I think. Anyway, has a lot of iron ore mines in South America.
It's Vale,
okay. Has a lot of iron ore mines in South America, and now the various nations in South America, including Brazil, are looking at those dams and saying, whoa, the rest of them, any of these could collapse at any time.
Right. Well, and they're correct in saying so. 2015, same company, the Mariana Dam disaster, which took out a couple of other villages, same company, iron ore, different country, but a lot of the countries that have been really, really lax on their regulation of this sort of thing, which is part of the reason why it's cheaper to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you,
right.
This is something we've talked about for a long time. We mine about, it's less than 10% of our own iron, and that fluctuates, but most recent numbers that I've seen is around the 6% level. 6% of our own iron. 73% of our own steel. Now, there's a huge differential there. The iron is more expensive to mine in the United States, even though it's really abundant, because we have to do, I'm going to be sarcastic here, and please hear this is a humorous sarcasm. We have to do these crazy things like keep our workers safe and not have them checking out the teeth of the lion from the inside. We have a lot of laws on safety, and they do increase the cost of the end product, but not as far as lives. It decreases the cost in human life. Those laws don't exist in many of the emerging countries. They haven't gotten there yet. They figure you're just as likely to die chopping down a tree as digging a hole in the ground or anything else that you might be doing, so why should we make a regulation? As the income rises, so too does the right that people say that, hey, I have the right to have at least the semi-assurance that I'm not going to die on the job. That increases prices. That's part of the reason why we're seeing labor price increases in China before the tariffs, is that they were making enough money that they started to value their own lives, which is a good thing. I would say it's a good thing.
The point I was going to make here is the price of iron ore in the last year has roughly doubled.
Yeah.
And yet,
and that there's no tariffs on that.
But we're in a position in the United States where the manufacturers of iron ore, the manufacturers of iron, had raised their prices because of the tariffs, and all of a sudden they are losing money because the price of the iron ore they have to buy, which is imported into the United States, has doubled. And so despite the increase in tariffs, which enabled iron manufacturers
steel manufacturers
in the United States to raise their prices and start hiring people, they've started laying people off again now because they got hit with an unexpected event. And therein is the problem.
Ripples. Lots of ripples.
The problem with saying, okay, we got a negative trade balance with China, so we're their biggest customer, and therefore we can't afford to throw some tariffs on there, and they've still got to do business with us. You're in the process of doing that. You're making the person who did this would be the president, is making an assumption about a steady state economy.
Right.
That nothing will change.
We change our sources when prices change.
And yes, we're moving. There's, interestingly enough, China's exports just jumped upward. Did you notice that?
Yes, but their exports to the United States just dropped. Their exports to the rest of the world just jumped because they're a lot cheaper now.
Well, it's an interesting little scenario. Their exports to Southeast Asia is the biggest jump they've had. And our imports to from Southeast Asia rose in accordance with that. So what they're doing is they're basically saying, we'll export a bunch of parts. Actually, they were exporting the whole thing, and it was getting shifted around, but then they had caught at that. But we export the parts to make something so it can be assembled easily to Vietnam.
or Thailand or Singapore
or Malaysia,
Indonesia.
And they'll assemble it and send it to the United States. And that way we can still export to the United States and get around the tariffs. So the tariffs were hurting China and China's economy's growth rate. Not the economy wasn't shrinking, but the growth rate was shrinking. And their manufacturing index has actually come to 49.9 or something, which is a slight contraction. But they are adjusting very quickly by exporting slightly unfinished products to countries where we don't have tariffs. So we'll either put tariffs up against everybody.
Which the president has been okay with in the past. So that could happen again.
Which would really give us a lot of pain. Or the Chinese are rapidly figuring out how to get around the tariffs, which is one of the reasons they're not very likely to budge in the trade war.
Right. Do you mind if we switch conversation
Certainly.
Points for a second?
Go
we
ahead.
Hit it before. Interest rates, refinancing of mortgages.
That's very interesting.
It is interesting.
It's interesting.
I'm very interested in interest.
Yes.
Rates. Rates on interest.
It rates a lot of interest.
The rate of interest on interest rates has risen lately.
It certainly has. And it's a good time to refinance if it makes sense and you're going to stay in your house for quite a while.
Yes. So if you have a mortgage that has very much time left in it at all.
And is up around 5%.
And is above the 5% mark, you should refinance. If you've got good credit, if you have the ability to do that, the banks are going to be reluctant. Expect there to be finger clamps and extreme questions about the income from your long lost maternal grandmother, because they want to know everything, because they're not going to make a profit on the loan. They're going to make a profit on making the loan to begin with, but then they have to sell it to somebody, and people really don't want to buy mortgages below 4%. And so that's the thing, is that there is a market out there. If you have excellent credit, you can get your mortgage refinanced. If you find somebody that's just really willing to work with you and you can bring down your interest rate by about a point, then do it. If you've got more than about 5 years left in your mortgage, if you've only got 2 years left in your mortgage, probably not a good idea to refinance just to save a point of interest. There are better things to do with that. If you just take the closing cost money on the and the signing costs and the all of that stuff and throw it at your mortgage, you'll be done with your mortgage pretty soon. All of that is good news for us. If you can get a mortgage at that rate, get it. That's why these mortgage refinances are up. And people used to think that a 4.5% interest on your mortgage was fantastic. Bankrate.com says right now the average, this is the average, this is not average of high credit people, this is the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is 3.88%. So that's a big deal. Let me see what Fannie Mae says about it. They always...
I remember when having a 10% mortgage rate was an exceptionally good deal, which tells you that I'm really old.
Yeah.
But inflation historically, and well, that's a whole different subject, but inflation historically has run a little over 3% in the United States over the last most of a century. So if you've got a mortgage rate that's down in the 3% rate, 3% range, 3.75 to 4%, you've got an exceptionally good deal where the loan is virtually costing you nothing. Now, that assumes that inflation rates are going to come back up to 3%. But that is a big question. That's something I'd like to talk about. There's a book, and I don't want to get away from your looking at interest rates.
Yeah, it'll be here in just a second.
There's a book called The Great Wave.
Fannie Mae is saying 3.6. 3.6% is with that 20% down payment that Fannie Mae expects and
if you do
good credit.
If you do a refi, there's going to be closing costs. And the point is you need to look at that and think about how long it's going to take to recoup your closing costs when you do this, but it's certainly worth looking at. And there's every indication, by the way, that interest rates will go lower. The question is whether the banks will make loans if interest rates go much lower.
Right. And if you consider that it was only November of last year that 30-year average rates at Fannie Mae were right underneath 5%. So now we're down at 3.6. That's a huge difference. If you can take advantage of it, do it.
Let me make a little correction to my statement on iron ore just a minute ago.
Okay.
I'd said it doubled, and it had, but my data was a little outdated. I'm just looking at a very recent chart, and apparently the price has gone from roughly $121 per ton to down to $94 per ton in the last week.
That's interesting.
And, again, the reason behind that, I just
– lowered demand.
This is an update. Is there's an anticipation that what's happening is the foundries, the places where they make steel out of iron ore, or they make iron and then they make steel, are basically shutting back down again and saying the demand in the United States has fallen off. Now, why is the demand fallen off? Frankly, a big piece of that is we've been talking about the fact that businesses have gone into negative growth, which is contraction on their investment spending. In other words, they're not spending, they're not building new buildings, which require in many cases a steel framework to put it up. They're not buying new equipment that requires steel. In other words, the demand for steel in the United States has dropped pretty dramatically. And again, we can credit that mostly to tariffs.
All right. We've got some commercials to play. I've got some interesting stuff to talk about, a new bill on Social Security, a couple of other things. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in, our phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I'm always kind of zeroed out after hearing that. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to jump into something.
You could assault the walls of Harfleur.
Yes. Charge. The head of the top Republican on the House Ways and Means Committee, that's the chairman of the committee. Well, it used to be the chairman of the committee, the senior Republican now. Kevin Brady has introduced a bill that touches Social Security. Okay, so what are we talking about here? I'm going to give some background. If you are a teacher or you know a teacher, this is important to you. Very important. Back in 1983, the U.S. Congress introduced and passed legislation called the Windfall Elimination Provision, otherwise known as WEP, which is a very good thing for me, and that I get to do these calculations and it looks like magic, and that I can predict how much money you're going to receive from Social Security, even though Social Security says you're going to get a completely different number. What happens is that if you're working as a teacher or a government employee at the state level, and rather than having money taken out and put into Social Security from your paycheck, it's taken out and put into a state-run pension program. That for teachers, it's the Teachers Retirement System, Texas Teachers Retirement System. So this concept exists out there. You're not paying into Social Security, so you shouldn't get Social Security. Well, that makes sense, except there were a lot of people that had paid into Social Security. They had paid for quite a few years, but not enough years to counteract this legislation in 1983. Why did they pass it in 1983? Well, first off, to make it easier for states to make a pension program for their teachers without being taxed twice, not without having, if you're a teacher, your TRS money coming out and your Social Security money coming out of your paycheck, that would be cutting into your living significantly. So they said, all right, we'll split the responsibility. The states get this, we get this. And in the process, we're going to cut out some Social Security that you already did earn. And Why did they do that? Because Social Security was projected to die. It was one of the measures that was put in place that extended life, the life of Social Security out to about 2025. So should someone that paid into Social Security be able to receive Social Security? What do you think about that as a philosophical question?
That is – the whole purpose in Social Security, though, is to fund as a philosophical question, no.
As a philosophical question, should everyone that pays in get it?
Right.
And if you look back at the intended purpose at the beginning of what Social Security was, it was never intended for everyone to get a retirement check. It was a safety net for the lowest income. So, okay, so it's kind of an entitlement program. Well, that's what it is, yeah. More like welfare than it is today. They made it kind of a Medicare for all type situation, only they called it Social Security for all. And they put everybody on the Social Security rolls. Everybody was paying in already. That's how they paid for it. Well, now everybody could get money out. Well, there's a problem with that. The problem is that there used to be a lot more workers per retiree. Now there's a lot fewer workers per retiree. We're at somewhere around 2.5 workers per retiree now. And back when Social Security was first introduced, there were 32 workers per retiree. That's a lot easier on the retirement bookmaking. If you're looking at the numbers and you've got 20 plus people working and you can take from their pay to pay for this retiree, it's great. That's an easy thing to do. And if you limit that so that we can put money away for the future, except that Congress has been spending that money. They don't have an easy way to save it. They give themselves IOUs. These are internal treasury bonds. So we have a really, as the British would say, a sticky wicket here. We have a problem. Social Security is not set to work very well. Problem one. Problem two, people who have paid into Social Security are not getting it if they have another kind of retirement. Those are called conflicting problems, and I think we can all agree that those problems are real. If a teacher paid in to Social Security for 15 years and then spends the next 25 years being a teacher, they may not get Social Security at all.
How many years do you have to pay in? How many quarters do you have to pay in to get Social Security?
You've got to have 10 quarters of significant income to get Social Security at all. Now, coming forward from that, they take your much larger period of time. There's 30 years that they're averaging together to get a really good number on how much you've made. If you worked 50, they just take your top 30 years. So the concept behind Social Security, who gets it,
so,
has problems associated with it. There is no fairness here.
But if a person worked 15 years and paid Social Security, and then they worked 15 years as a teacher, they would still get Social Security.
Amount, yes.
Yeah, but they'd still
If they worked 25 years as a teacher and made enough as a teacher, maybe they made it, they got their master's degree as they were working, went up into administration, and their income went up. Well, now they're not going to get much, if any, Social Security.
Well, they'll get some.
No. Above a certain level, it cancels out. And I've done this calculation quite enough. I've seen people get zero Social Security money. I've also seen people that have worked enough years in Social Security, did 30 years in a Social Security paying job, that it didn't affect them at all, the fact that they had TRS. So from the standpoint of good policy, if we take this at a household level rather than at a government level, and we say a bunch of kids in the family, they're getting their allowance, we're taking some of their allowance and they're putting it in a piggy bank for their college fund, but there's not enough money in the piggy bank for their college fund, and we're taking the kids that went and got a job at the neighborhood lemonade stand as well and saying, you don't need as much in your college jar. Well, that's a problem. Two problems. You don't have enough in any of the college jars, but specifically, you're putting less in there because they're earning somewhere else. How do you fix that? Well, the first thing you can do is bring in the voluntary side of this. All of this stuff that we're talking about is mandatory. You don't get a choice if you're a teacher whether or not you put money into Social Security or TRS, or whether or not TRS is going to pay you, or whether or not Social Security is going to pay you. Your only choices are on what you do with the rest of your stuff. We are entitled. The whole philosophical question of should I get paid after I have paid money in? The vast majority of Americans say yes to that question because it's an entitlement program. We paid into it, especially if you're getting close to retirement. So this concept that we have that somehow fairness needs to fit into this, that's a problem. That's the root problem there. The world is not fair. And Congress is certainly not fair. The IRS is not fair. They may follow their regulations to a T, but fairness is some other thing not quantified by law or regulation. If we're going to run out of money in Social Security, and we are introducing laws now to increase the amount of money that Social Security pays out while not increasing the money that it gets in, that just brings it closer. I am certainly not defending the way it was written because it definitely damages
what,
teachers.
Law?
Both, all of the laws, the new one, the old ones, all of it.
What is it Senator McConnell is proposing?
No, it's Brady.
Senator Brady, or Congressman Brady. What is he proposing?
Kevin Brady, yeah. He's proposing a different algorithm to run, which causes everyone to go, oh, well, that makes sense. It's an algorithm. Oh, I should be able to figure this out, right? Well, it's a different algorithm. You can choose this other algorithm. If you're between the ages of 21 and 59, you can choose this other algorithm to determine how much windfall you had from your windfall that needs to be eliminated. Now, let me take a step back and say, what is a windfall? Well,
when the wind blows and trees falls down.
Right. In ancient English common law, it was illegal for you to go out and cut down a tree because that's the Lord's tree. You can't cut that down. Now, if something falls on the ground, you can pick that up. That's firewood. You can make boards out of it, whatever you want. But if it's still standing, you can't cut it down, even if it's dead. But if a windfall happens, all these trees fall down, whole villages can be built off of that free of charge. I mean, people have to cut them up and so on, but it's a windfall. It was a gift. In this case, the windfall is not a gift. It's something you earned after you also earned Social Security.
Well, this is the point. If everybody gets their Social Security paid back to them,
right,
it won't work.
You're exactly correct.
Unless we dramatically raise a Social Security tax on all the people that are going to get the money paid back.
You're exactly correct. So what you've just said is the fundamental thing. We're trying to fix a thing that is not fixable in the concepts that we're using. Social Security is not a panacea. It is not a never-ending supply of money. It's based on the same fundamental facts of the economic world as anything else. And if a private organization were running a pension plan in the same way, it would be sending out letters to the expected recipients of the pension saying the pension is going to fail.
It really boils down to the fact that Social Security was designed to transfer wealth from people who are making money to people who
are not making money.
Who are not making money in their old age and who are poor.
Now, people have taken that to mean it's designed to take money from people who are working and give it back to them when they're not working. Mm-hmm. That's not how it works.
And, you know, Social Security is fixable. It's fixable fairly easily. It simply says that
right.
If you make above a certain amount of money, then your Social Security starts to trail off. And if you make a certain amount of money in any given year in your retirement, you don't get Social Security.
Right. And the way it's set up now, and I benefit from it, you benefit from it, above a certain income, you don't pay Social Security taxes on that income above
right.
that amount.
Right.
You have a cap. And that cap wanders around. And I long since gave up memorizing it every year. Because
it used to be $189,000.
I think it was $89,000. Now it's hovers right around $100,000 to $110,000. If you make more than that, then you're likely not to be paying Social Security taxes on the money above that. So if you make $400,000, you're only paying it on about a quarter of your income. Okay. Why? Well, because you're not gonna, you're capped out. You're gonna have the most from Social Security, so it wouldn't be, remember this word, fair to tax you more. Fairness is a dire thing in economics because it's not real. And everybody has a different definition for it.
$128,400.
Okay, $128,000. So if you make more than $128,400, any dollars that you make above that are not taxed for Social Security.
And below that, it's taxed at 6.2%.
And then you've got another one on it from the employer of 6.2 as well.
Right.
So it's
actually 12.4.
Right. So you've got 12.4% of your income, some of which you see and some of you don't. It's actually a higher number than that because it's added to the top of it. And you've got to look at it differently because your income might be $128,000. But if your employer is also paying Medicare and Social Security taxes on top of that for your employment, it means that should be included in that number as well.